and welcome to Manx Radio, where you're listening to our general election candidate interview series. I'm our election producer, Amy Griffiths, and on Thursday, the 24th of September, the island will decide who should have a seat in the House of Keys for the next 5 years. We're inviting all the candidates to take part in a 30-minute interview, telling us who they are, why they're standing, and why they deserve your vote. Up next is Julia Bell, who's standing in Eyre and Michael. She's been speaking to Lewis Foster.
Today, I'm talking to Julia Bell. Julia is an independent candidate standing in Eyre and Michael. She's a mental health nurse and cognitive behavioural therapist, and this is her first time standing in an election. Hello, Julia. Thank you for joining us. So, your first time standing in a House of Keys election.
Yes.
Not your first foray into politics, though, is it?
No. In 2024, I actually applied for LegCo. And I've been a public advocate for quite some time now, so I feel like I've been interested in Manx politics from the outside. But yes, I did apply for LegCo in 2024.
What was that experience like? How did that go?
That went well. I mean, obviously, I didn't get in. I wasn't elected into LegCo. But I was pleased with how I came across and how I performed during the hustings. And I was given a lot of encouragement from the House of Keys to apply. I got some votes. I obviously didn't get enough votes. I think I got 7 votes. The feedback I got was that I'm more suited to Keys. And I was encouraged to stand for the House of Keys in this general election by some members.
Why did they say that? What makes you an ideal candidate for the House of Keys?
I think they could see that I was interested in policy and how I have driven change already as a public advocate. I think that I was discouraged to say that I had an interest in policy, because obviously LegCo is all about scrutinising legislation, and that's the main role. And I saw that as an opportunity to contribute at a population level, and all strategies and policies, it's fundamental that we get legislation right, so they all contribute. But hand on heart, really where my heart lies is in policy. And despite being told or discouraged not to wear that during hustings, I didn't do that. And that was intentional and deliberate, and I knew that I probably might not get sufficient votes because of that, but I'm an honest person and I like to get into a role based on integrity, because that's something that I highly value.
Do you understand the role of an MHK, what the day-to-day looks like? Would you be prepared to take up that role straight away if elected?
I think if I were to be elected, it will be a steep learning curve, absolutely. But the role would be representing your constituents, listening to what your constituents want and what their lives are like, what the complications or problems that they're having, identifying themes that the public are having, and then changing policies that will help at a population level to resolve the types of problems that people are facing day to day.
What are the biggest concerns for the people of Eyre and Michael?
Okay, well, I mean, that would depend upon the different areas. Obviously, it's a rural area, so Kirkmichael, we've got the problem of coastal erosion. We have local amenities have been diminishing in Kirkmichael, so we've lost the shop and the pub. More broadly, agriculture is a huge matter. Farmers don't feel well supported, and we haven't got food security as a problem. I think I read that only 6% of our food is produced locally, and you know, that's important that we can produce our own food.
Have you been out door knocking yet? Have you met constituents in Eyre and Michael? What's the feedback you've had so far about what their main concerns are?
Yep, so yes, I've been door knocking. I've contacted businesses, I've contacted farmers, and I've gone door knocking door to door. At the moment, I've only recently started, so I've only been going around Kirkmichael, but I have every intention to go around other rural areas too. So in Kirkmichael, and it'll be interesting to see whether themes stay the same or whether they change. That's something that's going to be interesting. But in Kirkmichael, the main themes have been health and social care, and they've also been the cost of living, housing availability and affordability, government spending. Those have been, immigration's been a big one as well.
Now, housing was something that came up during the last general election, of course. So what do you think the Cannon government could have done differently, not just in housing, but altogether?
Okay. It can't be an easy job, because if it was easy, it wouldn't be a problem. But what I would have liked to see is, I don't understand why the mid-rent scheme didn't work in Colby, and perhaps that could have been done in Douglas, and then people may have had a bit more expenditure money because they wouldn't have been having travel costs as well with petrol. I don't know the ins and outs of how that scheme ran, but I would have liked to know whether they were monitoring, whether people were able to save early on and keep monitoring that and reviewing that regularly, rather than finding out at the very end that they weren't able to save, because I know only two people managed to benefit from getting onto the property ladder. I've heard, you know, just through listening to the debates, that the mid-rent scheme has worked in other jurisdictions. So how did it differ to what other jurisdictions would do? Like, how can it work in one area and not another? Did we do it differently? So I would like to see the mid-rent scheme tried again. And I know the public consultation went out, and that is what many residents have asked for that scheme to run again. I don't know whether they have looked into other ways of trying that I don't think we've seen. So sometimes there's companies that do flat pack housing. I think it's called modular housing, where it's produced in factories and then it's shipped here, and they can actually be, you know, carbon neutral and good quality and last a long time and sustainable. And have the Alamann government looked into that?
Is that what you would do if elected?
I think it's definitely worth looking into and seeing whether it's feasible.
Where would you put those? Greenfield sites?
Well, I think the public obviously want to prioritise brownfield sites first. So I think that it would be important to double check first that we couldn't rule that out. So I think we need to prioritise brownfield sites first and see whether that's feasible. And if it's not feasible, then consider using up our green spaces.
You've outlined your priorities. We'll come to those in a moment, but we have to talk about your role in the Dyslexia Advocacy Group. Explain to the listener who isn't aware what your role is there, what you achieved with that.
Yes. Okay, so for the last 6 years, I've been campaigning for improve identification for dyslexia and other specific learning difficulties too, providing increased support for these people. And this is based on my own personal experiences, because I've raised a child who struggles in school because of dyslexia and being neurodiverse. And it's been a battle, and I needed to identify whether am I the only one here, and if so, that's unfortunate and unlucky, or is this a common theme that other people are experiencing too? So it's been a long journey of being determined and working hard and persisting. And I did achieve some change by myself. The two local public consultations were done that provided local data, and that was done through a petition I did to Tynwald, and building a good working relationship with Dr. Allinson. So technically it wasn't on my own, because actually building relationships is fundamental. It's necessary, but not sufficient. But after Dr. Allinson moves post, because he changes his ministerial position, I was struggling to find momentum after that, despite trying. And when I managed to get a Tynwald member to give me an update, and I realised the update was brief, and it was the information was in the public domain, and the information was inaccurate. So that really consolidated that not enough is being done. So that's why I created Dyslexia Advocacy Group. I needed further evidence to prove that this is of public interest. And from there, we've achieved a great deal. We've got an inclusion policy now that was updated in 2024. We've got systematic phonics instruction, which was introduced in Key Stage 1. 11,000 children now have access to assistive technology, and that was achieved through me writing a letter to a global company in England and building a strong relationship with the CEO of that company. And the company absorbed most of the costs. So that was done with clinical governance in mind and saved the Isle of Man a lot of money.
So I suppose then, Julia, somebody on the doorstep might be thinking, well, you've shown you can dedicate yourself to something you're passionate about and you can focus on something. But what about the things that you're less concerned about but matter greatly to the constituents? Do you think you could give it as much weight as the issues that you care deeply about?
Yes, absolutely. This is something I have done that I knew nothing about. And, you know, I went beyond what I did I did a presentation to Tynwald members. I did a half an hour presentation to Tynwald members. 25 of minutes of that was me stating the facts, sticking to the evidence, and delivering a strong argument for change. The last 5 minutes was very small clips of the public who gave me videos with their consent, which I showed to Tynwald members with their consent. So it was half an hour in total. The feedback I got given from Tynwald members was that I got told it was perfect. I got told it was one of the best speeches they had heard in the room, which was the I can't remember the Barul Suite. And one member came up to me saying, "You belong in here." And so I've demonstrated I can do that on a topic that I know nothing about, simply out of passion. And I am passionate about many topics, and I have no qualifications in dyslexia. I have qualifications in mental health. That's my field of expertise. I'm a registered nurse. So I've done a degree in nursing, in mental health specifically, but I've also got a postgraduate diploma in CBT, and I do high-intensity CBT. And I would love to contribute at a population level to improve the well-being of the Isle of Man. And if you think about how that can be achieved, there's so many ways, because you've got to think about the wider determinants of health, and housing, access to housing contributes towards better mental health. Improving poverty and deprivation improves mental health. Field spaces and the environment. So many areas link all back to mental health. So as long as I know that I'm in an area that's impacting mental health, like our economy, there's a model, it's called Whitehead and Dahlgren, I think it's called, and it's got or the rainbow model, and you just have to look at that model to show you how many factors and variables influence our health and well-being. So that's why I'm going to be really passionate in whatever area I'm in.
Let's move on to one of your other priorities then. You mentioned it there, health, of course. What's wrong with the island's healthcare system as it is?
Well, when I've been door knocking, and obviously it's in the public domain quite a lot at the moment, access to GPs has been difficult for many people. So that's going to be an area that we'll need looking at and trying to improve. I think there is some work that's been got done that is obviously... is helping a little bit. I mean, we've introduced mental health first contact practitioners and rolled that out, and that's going to put pressure off GPs. I think the intention is to roll this out further. I would welcome that. And there is currently a pilot scheme. Well, sorry, it's not a pilot scheme at the moment. There is an initiative with the Northern Wellbeing Centre and the Western Wellbeing Centre, who've partnered with Kirkmichael Commissioners, and they offer drop-in centres every fortnight. And the wellbeing centres, the purpose of them is to run a holistic assessment of someone's needs and then make referrals to agencies, services, third parties, third sectors, charities. And that can definitely take pressure off GPs too, but at the moment I don't think it's well known, and so it hasn't been well attended. So I think it would be a good idea to publicise that, and obviously funding might be a problem, but it would be really good to pilot that initiative, and if successful, I would welcome the rollout of that service. And I think it would work particularly well for Aaron Michael, because it's such a rural area where people might find it really difficult to get to GPs.
Let's talk about it on a national scale, though. Of course, funding, Manx care overspending is cited as one of the biggest issues of this last administration. So how do you solve that problem?
Yeah, that's obviously a difficulty as well, because the question is, and I don't know until I'm in there, until I learn more information, are they overspending or are they not being given enough money, or is it a structural issue?
What's your instinct?
My instinct would be, I don't like to go by instinct. I think that's really poor practice. I think we need to look at the evidence and find out what the evidence is saying. When I have listened to the debates, I have heard some Tynwald members say that the budget is not taken into account that the cost of healthcare is rising faster than inflation, and we've got it's rising faster than the general cost of living, and in addition to that, staff have had pay increases. I mean, there's one ongoing now. There's a risk of industrial action again with the doctors that are disputing pay. So with all these pay rises, which obviously, I mean, I'm a nurse, I've been impacted by this and been offered pay rises as part of that too. So it's really hard to know without being on the inside and being given all the information and the data.
And you'll appreciate, Julia, of course, when it comes to making a decision around whether it's new taxation or whether you start cutting services, it's a difficult decision to make. Will you be strong enough to make that decision?
So it's about whether services are cut or not. Well, I mean, when that is done, you obviously have to think about what are the absolute services that cannot and are the priorities, and then look at which ones are nice to have. Like, for example, the closure of the Ramsay Hospital, the Ramsay Cottage Hospital, on the weekends. You know, I'd probably argue out of all the services that Manx Care offer, that probably is more of a sensible idea if funding is a problem.
Can we stray now outside of your list of priorities? And I want to talk a bit more about the island's economy. What do you think would be the key to the success of the island's economy over the next 5 years? The position we're in right now isn't fantastic,
no,
to say the least. So what do we do? How do you stimulate growth again, Julia?
Yeah. So what I know that there's been an agenda to increase the population to 100,000 people. I think it's by 2037, if I remember that correctly. I would like to change the narrative a little bit on that and say the goal would be to rebalance the population, because we've got an aging population. And although the ageing population is an asset to the Isle of Man, I mean, I've worked with older people before as a voluntary role and as a paid role in older persons' mental health services. However, older people are naturally going to have more comorbidities, more health problems, and that's going to cost more money to fund in terms of health and social care, for example. And that's going to cost more money in terms of funding pensions too. So the solution to this is to attract younger people to the Isle of Man so that we can reduce the dependency ratio and have more economically active people working. That's going to contribute towards public services, pensions, social security benefits, and hopefully be able to keep then the triple lock.
I think you know what I'm going to ask you now. How do we do that?
Okay, so we need to build the infrastructure. They need to be done hand in hand. I think it goes back to housing a lot. I've been employed in Manx Care, and I've seen this happen where we've got a post that's vacant. Someone has the interview, they get the job, and then later we find out that they can't take the post after all because they can't find housing, or if they have found a house, it's not affordable. So I think it goes back to housing and sorting the housing crisis out and making housing more affordable. But we also have to attract people by thinking about, well, what pulls people to the Isle of Man? Let's find out the people who've come to the Isle of Man and what's pulled them here. And I've been doing that on the doors by saying when some people are new, even if they can't vote, I'm saying, well, they can't vote because they haven't been here 12 months or longer. I ask them, what attracted you to the Isle of Man? I'm interested in understanding that. And, you know, it's safe, smaller commute times, it's a slower pace of life. You know, we've got a lot of nature here, we've got a good heritage. And so, we need to advertise the strengths that the Isle of Man already has.
One thing missing from that list, hospitality. What do you make of the hospitality industry? It's struggling at the moment.
Yeah.
Recruitment is a big issue. How do you solve that?
Yeah, so I actually met with one business owner and I contacted that person proactively to understand the struggles of the hospitality sector. And since the shared VAT agreement, it's been more of a struggle because hospitality sectors feel like they've lost 20% of their profits since the agreement. And I know that the Isle of Man government has followed suit with what the UK have done in terms of for it not to apply for children and families, which obviously, you know, I would welcome. But some hospitality sectors like pubs who don't target families are going to suffer. And a consequence of that is that many pubs or hospitality in general are at risk of closing. And I think that, coupled with the minimum wage rising, has impacted that sector too. And it's really difficult because people who are on minimum wage and aren't earning much, and with the cost of living, we do have to consider those people too. It's a constant balancing act and really, really hard to please everyone with these decisions. Hence, yeah, politics, advantages and disadvantages to everything.
Speaking of politics, it's a little bit hard to tell on the Isle of Man with the number of MHKs that we have, where they sit in the political spectrum. Would you describe yourself as left-wing, right-wing, centrist?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you stand?
I am quite confident in saying that I am more to the left. Because of my background in nursing and my background in mental health, and understanding that poverty and deprivation contribute towards that and poor living conditions. In my nursing degree, it was very much part of our education was understanding the determinants of health and the inequalities of health, and that stuck with me. So I would also like, when I do make voting decisions, I will always, I think part of me would always be thinking about what are the inequalities of health and how can we reduce those inequalities of health?
Mm. Net zero, green issues, where do you stand?
Mm-hmm. So I support net zero or getting down as close to net zero as possible. I believe in the science behind climate change. And, you know, we know that the weather is becoming more extreme and, you know, we're at risk of droughts and storms and extreme weather, and you know, this is having an impact on our economy. And I think the World Health Organization say it's the biggest threat to humans. So I am in support of net zero, and I am pleased that the Climate Change Act 2021 has come about to make it mandatory for future administrations.
And we have to talk, of course, about renewable energy projects, mm-hmm. because it's going to be an election issue, whether we like it or not. Offshore wind farm, onshore wind farm. Let's start with Eerie Stain and the onshore wind farm. Would you support that project?
I support renewable energy. Without knowing all the information, it's difficult to know whether you'd support it or not. I do support renewable energy, and I do support the principles of onshore and offshore as well. And I think we have to look at the science behind this and make a distinction between what's fact and what's hearsay, and the majority views and the minority views. And I'd like to understand that better because I don't have that understanding. So it will be really important to understand what the majority of the constituents want. And I haven't got that information. But because I support net zero and I believe that climate change is real, overall, where my stance is now is I do support the wind farm projects.
Yeah. And on the doorstep, this hasn't come up yet?
It has come up. People have asked to me. And I will be consistent in my approach that I do support climate change interventions. I do support net zero. You know, I think it's really important for our biodiversity, you know, and it's essential for human health.
Someone says to you, I won't vote for you if you're in favour of the wind farm. What do you tell them?
I would say that, of course, it's always possible that you learn new information. I will never be the type of person where just because I have a view now doesn't necessarily mean my view won't change. I think that's really unhealthy. My views will always change depending on, you know, what the experts are saying in the field and what the research is saying and what the evidence is saying. And so just because I think something now doesn't necessarily mean that won't change. But I will stand by, you know, the principles of what is the evidence saying, what are the majority of the constituents wanting, what are the experts saying in the field, what is the science. And I have to base decisions on those four things to act with integrity.
You outlined three things on your priorities. I'll just recap them. They were education, health and housing. If you had to add one more, what would it be? What did you leave out?
Nursing homes. I mean, that's social care, so it doesn't quite... Does that count?
We'll allow it.
Okay. So, because that's health and social care, because obviously healthcare is free at the point of access. Social care is not free. Currently, there's a very unfair system to funding it. I worked in older persons mental health services, so I've seen the impact of this, and people have been telling me on the doors this problem. Some people get it completely free. Other people have to use up all their savings and then sell their home. I've met people who've had to move out of homes and not have homes because of it, because they've lived in their parents' home, for example, and it's causing a lot of problems. And I would like to contribute. This has been an ongoing problem for not just this administration. It's been ongoing, and I've seen it on manifestos 10 years ago that it was on there. So I would like to help to make the system fairer and review the funding models. And there was a public consultation done to ask the public, you know, what they would prefer. And the two top choices was the mixed care model, where the cost is shared, and the free personal care model. So I think I'm in favour of the mixed care model, where, you know, the maximum amount a person pays is capped. And I would like to contribute towards rolling that out.
Okay. Julia, we are coming up to the end now. So just tell me then, why should someone in Eyre and Michael give you their vote this September?
Okay. So I feel like I have given myself some merit and credibility based on being a public advocate and delivering meaningful change at a population level, having known nothing about it 6 years ago and getting to the point where, you know, so many people come to me for advice. I did a presentation that allowed a select committee to be established. They produced a report, and the 12 recommendations were debated in Tynwald very recently, and they were all approved. And the feedback that I've been given is that I am determined and that I persist, that I persist long after others give up, and that I deliver change in a way that's caring and compassionate and respectful.
Okay. And we're coming up to about 30 seconds left, so okay. Just anything else you'd just like to wrap up now?
Yeah, so I am holding some public consultations across Eyre and Michael, and if you would like to come and see me, then have a look at my Facebook page, Julia Bell, which will advertise those venues. I will go out as much as I can to doors, but come and see me if I don't make it.
That was Julia Bell, who's standing for election in Eyre and Michael. Also standing in the constituency are Stephen Broad, Alfred Cannon, Steve Kerfey, Tim Johnston, Mary Phillips and Paul Weatherall. You can listen back to this interview, along with all the others recorded as part of this series, shortly after broadcast from your usual podcast provider. And don't forget about our dedicated election website, which has everything you need to know ahead of the general election. You can find it, as always, at manxradio.com.